Hello, and welcome to the Physical Preparation Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Robertson, and I will be joined on the line later today by George Carvajal. Now, before we get into this week's show, there are times I really want to rah-rah boost you guys up a little bit, and there's other times I'm going to bring it down, and I'm just going to be 100% real with you. So today is one of those days. The swag, the mojo, a little bit lower than usual. Just got some things going on that I'm trying to push through, you know. And that's, number one, that's how it works, right? Nothing is linearly on the up and up all the time. So today's one of those days. Gary Schofield's going to be pissed, but I got to grind a little bit, got to push through. And the message for today is very simple, right? Like, even though my swag is a little bit lower today, don't quite have the juice that I would, you know, normally have, at the end of the day, you have to do your best work every day, right? And so, you know, when I leave home, when I get this posted, when I walk out the door today, I'm going to go to the gym and I'm going to give my best effort. I'm going to put in my best work. And it's my goal as a coach or as a trainer for my athletes to never have an idea if I'm having a bad day. I don't want them to even have that idea cross their mind. I want them to be like, man, this guy is just even Steven every single day. And, you know, to give you some insight into this, Jay Chung, who is our morning coach at IFAST, man, this guy has like, I don't remember how old Luca is now, but like a 9-10 month old at home. He's our morning guy. So he's at the gym at 5:30. He works from 6 to noon on the floor. You know, he stays after a lot of days and works with the interns or does, you know, meetings and such with us. This guy is, you know, like the ideal employee. And I tell you what, this guy could sleep 2 hours the night before and you wouldn't be able to tell when he's on the gym floor. Right? Like every day he brings his A game. And so I would implore you guys to do the same. And don't just take this from the aspect or the idea of coaching, right? Like, do your best work when it's your time to study, right? When it's time to do your con ed. And, you know, look, not every day is perfect. Maybe you're not going to get an hour every day. Maybe you're not going to get 30 minutes every day. Let's say you only get 15 minutes of con ed working today. That's fine. But make sure that you shut the rest of the world out, get your mind right, and make those 15 minutes really valuable. Because I think if we can kind of have this mindset of, you know, like we're bringing our A game every day. And look, your A game may vacillate from day to day, right? It's like lifting. You know, some days the weights feel really heavy and you just don't have it, but you still put in your best effort. And then there's other days when, you know, the weights feel super light. You're just bouncing out of the bottom of your squat, or you're just, you know, throwing that bar every time you bench press. Like, look, that's life, right? Ups and downs, highs and lows, that's how it's going to work. But if you guys get in the habit of bringing your best, bringing your A game every single day, and knowing that, you know, it's not the same day to day, that's okay. But if you bring that A game every day, I guarantee you are going to move the needle in your life, in your coaching practice, and everybody around you is going to be drawn to you, because we need more people that are ready to bring that A game every single day. So I'm not going to ramble any further. Remember, make every day great, bring your A game, give your best effort every single day, and I promise you will be rewarded. So enough from me, let's get into the show with George. George Carvajal is a performance coaching consultant who has worked with elite athletes in multiple sports and the tactical world for over 25 years. He has trained thousands of athletes at the University of Florida, the University of Nebraska, the U.S. Olympic Training Center, along with numerous professional athletes from the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, NHL, World Surf League, Big Wave Tour surfers, and tactical athletes in the fire service, law enforcement, SWAT and SRT, and military communities. In this show, George and I discuss how we built a coaching practice around life, why athletes need to be sold, and some insights into his people-first philosophy. George is just an incredibly interesting guy to talk to. He's got great insights, and we have some great back-and-forth discussions. I really think you're going to enjoy this talk. Let's do this. George, thanks so much for coming on the show here today. It's great to have you on. Could you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on. I am a performance coach, consultant, primarily working with NFL athletes, the tactical world, primarily special ops, and some big wave surfers. That kind of in a nutshell is what I'm doing right now.
That's awesome. And what originally led you to the world of physical prep?
It was an accident, or I should say accidental. Okay. As a result of an injury. I was a pre-med student while going to school to become an orthopedic surgeon. That was sort of the end point. And at the time, I was also a walk-on football athlete. And after suffering multiple concussions over a 14 to 15-month period, essentially my football career was over. It came to an end. And I was approached by the head strength coach at the school at the time. And he asked me if I was interested in a strength and conditioning class that he taught. And to me, really, strength and conditioning at that point was really just a means to an end. All I knew about strength and conditioning was that it allowed me to play football by getting me bigger, faster, and stronger. Yeah. That was it. He told me, you know, just check it out. I did. I enrolled in the class, which was really nothing more, Mike, than cleaning up the weight room. That's what it ended up being. There was not a lot of apprenticeship in there. There was no mentoring. It certainly wasn't an internship. It was basically just come in and, you know, clean up for an hour. But it did give me a glimpse into sort of behind the scenes of how strength conditioning worked at the college level. And that got me intrigued.
So that's where you get your start. But I know there's so much more to your story. Like you kind of alluded to before we got on the air, you're the guy that's new to the scene that's been doing this for 25 years. So would you mind like filling in the gaps? Because, again, I've done some homework on you, and I think you just have such a unique story, the different places you've been, the people you've come across. So I would just love to hear, like, okay, you get your start in this weights class or, you know, basically cleaning up the weight room. How do you go from there to where you're at now?
So after that class, I was selected to do an exchange at the time what was known as the Russian State University of Physical Education in Moscow. It's now known as Moscow State U. And that is where my roots were established. It's where my philosophy, my principles began filling up and the maturation process of coaching began. It was a time filled really with not complexity, but simplicity. And that's important to know. It was all about the programming, the program that was built directly from the needs of the sport and the individual needs of the athlete. There was no accelerometers, GPS, HRV, no timing systems. The timing systems was a good old stopwatch. But what you did have and what I did witness was a tremendous amount of athletic success. Mm-hmm. The foundation that I built there carries me to this day, and I return to it daily, and I kid you not when I say that. So after I returned home, I applied for and got a GA position at the University of Florida, which is where my speed development learning started to take place. You know, Florida plays in the SEC, which is known for its fast athletes and fast offenses. And I started to see the benefit of speed development work. It's not something I had learned really before. Things like the importance of, for example, acceleration mechanics, mm-hmm. of perfecting the reps, and the thought that small improvements in max velocity has a dramatic effect on acceleration. From the GA position, I saw that there was an opening at Nebraska, which at the time was essentially the birthplace of strength and conditioning in this country, with Boyd Epley at the helm. Didn't really even know who Boyd Epley was. I just knew that that was a place where if I wanted to keep moving that I might aspire to. And so I got selected, and that was another trip that was deep down the rabbit hole. Super, super exciting to be at ground zero for what was the development of Husker Power, which remains to this day. From there, I had opportunities to then start applying for different sort of conditioning jobs around the country. But what happened is I got challenged by my father. My father said, rather than work for somebody, do you think you can do this on your own? And I didn't really know the answer to that question. But I knew that if I didn't try, I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. And I did. And then there sort of was the birthplace of what Carver Hall Performance is now. That's how it kind of basically started. I just went out on my own.
Really? So, like, right out of the gate, you just said, I'm going to do this and figure it out, huh?
Yeah, and I'll tell you what was the – which is kind of – when I look back at it, it's kind of an odd thing to think about or say at the time, because now, you know, there's like 10,000 coaches for each position, right? Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily a dime a dozen positions, so people are willing to work for pennies just to get into a spot.
Yep.
But at the time, the few jobs that were available at the time, Mike, I remember clearly the starting salary was somewhere between $19,000 and $23,000. Mm-hmm. Kind of, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was at the poverty level or below. Mm-hmm. In fact, my roommate at the time worked at McDonald's and was actually making more money. We sat down and broke out a calculator and figured it out. He was actually going to be making more money than I was. So I thought, that's insane, because you're working long days, you know, long hours, not a lot of downtime. You wake up with the sun, you come back home when it's dark. And it's not that I really wanted to be compensated. I just thought that that was somewhere and somehow unfair. And if I could go out and do it on my own, I figured that was could always be plan B. It's just to start applying to different schools. And I did.
Yeah.
I just started the process, and you know, it just started rolling. And I kind of liken it to just jumping in the deep end of the pool without knowing how to swim, wearing a 100-pound weight vest. That's what it was like.
That's awesome, man. So let's start with a really basic question, and you and I kind of discussed this already, but I've got a really unique path. I kind of want to take this show, but let's just start with a basic question. Give me your kind of overarching philosophy when it comes to coaching athletes.
So anyone who knows me knows that I live by a very, very basic philosophy, which is people first. I build relationships with people first and the athletes second. That's the way I go building relationships and starting that practice of what a philosophy is. You know, I realized early on that coaching is really part of the service industry, you know, not the hotel restaurant business, part of this, what people consider to be the service industry, but really you provide a service. And I've always enjoyed that cliche term, you know, because I like helping people. But the truth is, I really do. Coaching is just basically the form and the medium that I use to express that. As that philosophy started to build, then I started to put in some principles that really carried that philosophy, which were a little bit different than what the people first was. And we'll talk about that later, which was number one is making sure that I work all phases of muscle contraction, eccentric, isometric, and concentric. And I use the Cal Dietz's triphasic system, and I've had great, great success with it. The second principle that makes up that philosophy is fatigue must be managed. You and I and coaches and essentially all the listeners of this podcast, for the most part, whether you call yourself a physical preparation specialist, a performance enhancer, or something like coach, what we all really are, Mike, is we're load managers.
Yes.
We apply load and we help the athlete recover from those imposed loads in order to get adaptation or supercompensation. And so now for me is I put a huge premium on managing fatigue. And it's a front line target when working and designing athlete development programs. I know you had Aaron Davis on here, mm-hmm. and I'm a big fan of his thought process, and I mirror some of his thoughts when it comes to respecting and managing fatigue. And for me and for us personally, it's been a game changer. And the number three thing that makes up that philosophy is mistakes are necessary. I have made more mistakes than probably everyone listening to this times 10. What that's done for me personally is allow me to fail without consequence, because growth comes from failure. I know that I'm not afraid to question things. I'm not afraid to experiment. And I understand that I'm going to fail 10,000 times. And that's cool with me. And so those are the things that kind of build and upon that philosophy.
Man, I really like that. And one thing that you said stands out to me, because I was just having this discussion with one of the young coaches that trains at our facility today, and you can tell he's really overwhelmed by the idea of writing programs. And I told him, at some point, you just gotta make it happen, right? Like, you're going to make the mistake. And I think that's the big thing. He's afraid to make mistakes. And
right.
And that's what I was trying to, in a way, in my, you know, I'm your boss kind of way, but like, you know, comfort him. Like, look, you're going to make mistakes. Like, I've made mistakes. Like you said, I've made who knows how many. I don't even want to try and keep count. But that's necessary, right? Because every one of those mistakes you learn from, and ultimately it makes you a better coach. It makes you a sharper program designer. So I think it's so beneficial. Like, don't discredit that part of the process.
Absolutely. And it gives you a suit of armor, I'd like to refer to it, when it comes to mistakes, because you there is a threshold and a point that you cross where you're no longer afraid to make mistakes. And that is when the magic happens, because you're able then to just see the matrix.
Mm-hmm. I love it. So let's follow up on that, because I get a lot of young coaches that listen to this show. You know, they're looking for guidance. They're looking for people that have been there and done that. How would you advise a young coach to go about building their own philosophy?
You sort of touched on that a little bit. When you start out, you seem to want to follow everyone out there and read every book and listen to every podcast. And what that does, it creates a lot of noise, which creates then fear to a point where you start developing analysis by paralysis. Now you pick someone whose philosophy seems to speak to you, and you see what they're doing, and most importantly, the why of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Before adopting Cal Dietz's triphasic system, my philosophy really jived with the West Side conjugate system. Why? Because essentially that's what I learned in Russia, and that's what one of my coaching mentors uses to this day. But something happened several years ago. Two of my athletes had preseason ACL injuries, and I was devastated. Mm-hmm. I took it very, very personal. I started to look into my program and specifically the why of what I was doing. And I really didn't have an answer, which kind of shocked me. I did what I did because those that came before me and taught me used it, and they were all successful, as it was I. Mm-hmm. But as in everything, everything works. Nothing works forever.
Yes.
When I looked at my programming, I realized I really didn't put an emphasis on something really simple, which is eccentric muscle contractions. Not just from a performance enhancement aspect, but from an injury prevention standpoint. Eccentric contractions permits the muscular and tendinous support structures. It permits the muscular and tendinous support and strain, and it strengthens the muscular actions of articular stabilizations.
Yep.
It helps build, you know, robustness in both tissues and the structures. So, you know, I switched because I didn't understand my why before. And when I switched to Cal's system and the triphasic system, I started to understand the why. Mm-hmm. And the why led to essentially – certainly you can't stop injuries, but a reduction in injuries by following a system that just builds robustness in the system, again, the tissues and structures. So you sort of develop your philosophy by gathering select information. You try out different systems. Again, not being afraid to fail. You're going to fail. That is part of the process. And most importantly, whatever philosophy, whatever individual you decide to follow and choose, you have to understand the why. The why has to make up a large aspect of what your philosophy is. If you do not understand your why, then you really don't have really a philosophy. What you have is a lot of noise.
You know, something I got asked about yesterday was, you know, if you're trying to get into something, like, what do? Do you just go out there and try and collect information? Like you alluded to, like, that's overwhelming, right? And it's really hard to do that successfully.
Absolutely.
Because you get all this noise, and it's combined with the fact that you don't have a filter when you're young, you know? So the advice I gave this particular guy was, look, I would rather you find one or two people that you really jive with, that you really trust, and just take everything that you can from them. right? Let them be your filter. Let use their system until you're comfortable with it. And then once you start to have a better idea of what's really going on, as you described, you know, once you have an understanding of the why, then you can go out and start looking to other resources and pulling other elements in. But until you have that base foundation, until you have that filter in place, it really doesn't make sense. And all you end up doing is confusing yourself and muddying the water.
That's a great piece of advice. Absolutely great piece of advice. And I do the same, is just pick one guy, one dude, whatever it is, and whoever it is that, again, just jives with what your thought process is. It's someone you seem to be liking a lot, whether on Facebook or Twitter, you just seem to like their information. Just go down the rabbit hole with that individual. And then you're going to have to start actually implementing stuff, right? Because it's all theoretical.
Yep.
It sounds nice. And then you'll start seeing in theory where, you know, I know you've, as I have, gone to conferences or workshops, and we come back with your notebook full of stuff, and you start implementing stuff, and you start realizing, well, that didn't work. It doesn't all work, but you have to implement it. Sometimes it sounds really nice on a slide and out of a speaker's voice at a seminar or a conference or stuff, but not everything applies. So understanding the why is important, but you have to start somewhere. Just pick someone, follow them. It doesn't necessarily need to be the guy that has the most followers or has written 10 books. Maybe that doesn't really speak to you.
Right.
So that's a great piece of advice. I love that, and I do the same.
Perfect. And something else that you've mentioned, I know, numerous times in the past, is the idea that athletes need to be sold. And I'll be honest, I couldn't agree more. But would you mind explaining that statement just a little bit?
Yeah, for me, being sold, the concept of quote unquote buy-in is really about trust, right? That's that's what I learned early on. It's really about trust. And that's the whole concept of the why in my people first philosophy. I want to build a relationship with an athlete as a person before I build it as a coach and an athlete. And trust is about your character and your integrity. You know, my father gave me a very simple piece of advice. It's very applicable here. And to the concept of buy-in and building relationships. And he said, say what you mean and do what you say. I think that's something that really, really has always helped me. It's just simple. When you're in coaching, it's about trust. It's about relationship. Do you call when you say you're going to call? Mm-hmm. Are you on time? You say you're going to be on time. And I flip that into how do I get buy-in, or how does an athlete get buy-in from me? Which, right, because that's a back and forth relationship. And the things I look for, Mike, is did you call or did you text when you say you were going to call or text? Did you show up late and have 10 excuses? The moment I start seeing that, I start losing whatever buy-in you need from me in order to coach you well.
Mm-hmm.
And that in turn is the other way around. So it really buy-in, building that relationship, it is all about trust. It's simply about trust. It's be a person of your word and be a person that has integrity and character. That is the foundation of what buy-in is.
You know, something you just said really just clicked for me. So I totally buy in to the fact that, like, I believe, like, I have to constantly sell my service, and what I'm bringing to the table to the athlete. But I never thought about the flip-flop of that they have to sell themselves to you. And, when you said that, it just reminded me of, two things that I always look for in athletes. And it's so simple, right? And I know you're probably going to agree with this, but, like, I'm always looking for the guy that runs through the line, and I'm always looking for the guy that is going to go through the full time. So if it says 30
Absolutely.
Seconds, I want 30 full seconds. Don't come down at 29 when I'm counting backwards. When I count one and you come down, that makes me worried. It's just so interesting. Like, it's just those little things that I never thought of. But, like, as a coach, I'm absolutely, like, maybe not in a negative way, but I'm kind of judging this guy. Like, that tells me a lot about you.
You absolutely are, and you're doing it. Once you get the buy-in, again, then you're good. But in that initial establishment of the relationship, it is, and I do the very same thing. If you're quitting when we're counting down to 3, 2, 1, and you're quitting at 4 or 5, mm-hmm. that's about work ethic. And is it what I do? Is it me? Are we having an engine problem? And most
right.
of the time, that's not it. It's a character problem.
Yep.
And once we understand that, hey, I need you to finish, if this is an individual that continues to fall short, we're probably not going to be working very long together. I know that. It's happened to me a couple times where I've had to fire the athlete. Right? How many times have you actually seen a coach fire an athlete? It doesn't happen because we're all looking at this in terms of making money and establishing a career. And I'm very, very grateful that I do not coach for money. So money is irrelevant to me. So it gives me a certain amount of power to be able to pick and choose an athlete and realize that if you're not willing to give what needs to be given, then we can't work together. And crossing that line and touching the line and finishing strong is super, super important, because I'm judging you as much as you're judging me. And in order for us to get to the next level, it has to be a complete buy-in from both sides.
I love that. That's awesome. Okay. So one other thing that really helped me, and I think you and I share a commonality in this regard. You know, years ago, I kind of had this realization because I was a little bit burned out. I was working very, very hard. I think we had just had our second kid at the time. And I kind of had this very stark realization that, like, look, I'm putting a lot of energy into this, and that's fine. But it took me a while to realize that I am living a life of service, right? Like, as a coach, as a family man, like, I live a life of service, and especially in the coaching world. And, you know, I know you've mentioned that as well, that you live a life of service. So I'm just interested, like, what does that mean to you?
That's what coaching is, right? You're yep. serving. And a lot of coaches forget that and see it as a means to an end. Again, having a career and making money. And the truth is that you're serving. And if you sit and you think upon that term, it has a potential to change everything about you and everything you do. If you took away the concept of salary and making money, and I'm not saying that's important, because we all need to eat and we all yes. need to have a roof over our heads, right? Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You have to meet those needs first before right. you actually self-actualize. But it's super, super important to understand that if you get into the business, and it goes back to understanding the why. Why do you coach? If your intent and your head is in the right place, and you understand at the atomic level that the reason you coach really is because you really like to serve, your coaching practice will completely and utterly change. It will never be the same. It can't be the same. And you're going to grow leaps and bounds, because the truth of the matter is not everybody who's in coaching is there to serve. They're mm-hmm. there for a thousand different reasons. And you can pinpoint those individuals that are truly there to serve. Mike, you know, and I know, we can see these guys. It's palpable. You can see it.
Yeah.
It's very, very different.
Yeah. It's so interesting because, you know, like I said, for me, I was kind of struggling at the time. I think I was just, burning the candle at both ends, so to speak. And once I kind of had that realization of, okay, this makes sense to me. This is what I do. This is who I am. It was like this weight was lifted off my shoulders, and it made everything that I did so much easier. So it's just really interesting to hear you say that as well. Now, one other thing that you've obviously done for the greater part of your career is you've trained pro athletes. And again, a lot of young coaches, when they get in the field, like, that is the pinnacle, right? That is the top.
Right.
So as a guy that's done this for the better part of his career, what advice would you give to young coaches who aspire to work in that world?
You know, I get asked this question probably once a week, and I kid you not. How do I work with elite athletes? How do I work with NFL guys? And my answer used to be, I have no idea. Because the truth of the matter is that I didn't plan it. I didn't plan to work with NFL guys or spec op guys or big wave surfers. It just sort of kind of happened. Having said that, I did start getting a little bit of an insight, and this happened recently while I was talking to a couple friends who were Hollywood agents to celebrities. And in conversation, we all started to talk about, whether it was in sports, the movie business, or the business world, that people in almost all of the top positions got there by one means, right? They got a call.
Mm-hmm.
Started to recall literally hundreds of incidents that we each personally knew about. And in each case, a call was made. And we thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. And that conversation took us down the rabbit hole. And so now what I would say is the best way to work in that area, best way to work with elite athletes and NFL guys, is to do the best damn job you can right where you are. That's it. That's my simple answer to a lot of people. It doesn't matter where it is. Aspirations to greatness and goals are great, but stop looking for the next best thing and be the next best thing. Be the best coach you can be in your area. However you need to do that, by getting whatever education or experience you can, because when you start standing out from the herd, here's the thing, Mike, and I know you know this to be true, as I do, people will notice you. Mm-hmm. And when people start noticing you because you're doing a great job right where you're at, calls get made and the phone rings. I did not plan to be where I'm at, not at all. In many ways, it was the farthest thing from my mind. I did aspire, as I've always have, to be the best damn person at whatever it was I was doing. Mm-hmm. That's just in my genetic makeup. Excellence is important to me, as is mastery. And so I set out to develop excellence in myself first, and in the field of strength and conditioning second. And then, and only then, did the phone start ringing and I ended up where I am.
So something that we talk to parents about, because, you know, we get a lot of parents that, you know, they want little Johnny to play baseball 11 months out of the year, or Susie's going to play 12 months of soccer. And they're really worried, like, oh, well, you know, how are people going to find them if they're not playing soccer year round? And we always try and, you know, ease their tension a little bit. And we tell them, look, if little Johnny's that good, somebody will find him. You know what I mean? Like, there's people, like, the world is more connected now than ever before. It could be a YouTube clip. It doesn't matter. Like, if they're that good, they'll find you. And it's the same thing in coaching. Like, if you're that good and if you're putting in that much effort and that much work, it's going to shine through. And somebody, like you said, somebody's going to go to bat for you and you're going to get a chance or you're going to get an opportunity. But you're absolutely right. Like, don't start thinking about the gig that's 2 or 3 or 4 years down the line. Like, do the best damn job that you can in the place that you're at now, and chances are all the things that are going to happen to you down the line will happen because you put in the work early on.
You know, when I started sometimes complaining that maybe I had applied for a strength and conditioning job at the collegiate level or with a pro team, my dad's response was always the same. He would say, "Are you the best damn coach in Fort Lauderdale?" And he would just walk away. And he did that repeatedly over and over and over, reminding me that unless I aspired to be the best damn coach right where I was, none of that other stuff was possible. And then at some point, what I did was I actually stopped applying. And I just start applying myself to right where I was, to be the best damn coach right where I was. And only then, after I forgot about moving forward and doing, again, like you said, the 2, 3, 4, 5 year plan.
Yep.
Not that I didn't have aspirations or goals, but they became kind of more something in the back of my head, and I just focused in the here and now. Then and only then life changed. It was, and it keeps happening over and over and over to other people that I know, as you know too. It just, the call comes because you've established mastery and excellence over yourself and in the place where you're at.
I love it. I love it. So we as coaches talk a ton, especially nowadays, about keeping our athletes healthy. But if I recall, I think I heard that you were actually giving a talk in the last year about keeping coaches healthy. So would you mind kind of elaborating on that a little bit? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, we talk a lot about athlete fatigue and overtraining, under recovery, readiness, etc. But what we never talk about is coaching fatigue or coaching overtraining or coaching readiness. It's sort of the pink elephant in the room, somewhat of a taboo subject. This year alone, I've probably spoken to no less than about 15 coaches who felt burnout by the grind of coaching and wanted basically out. And what I was able to do is sit down with them and sort of kind of figure out where they were and sort of a plan to kind of sort of reinvent themselves and maybe see coaching in a different light, which allowed them to continue to enjoy the art and science of coaching. You know, resiliency in life and in coaching is a skill, but it's not something you're taught in school. We certainly don't seek it out. What we do instead in the profession is we read the latest training book, right? Try to apply its theories to what we do. And in the meantime, what we're doing is we're just adding weight and a weight belt after weight belt at the deep end of the pool until you feel like you're drowning. It's really about understanding, again, the why of your coaching. And how you build resiliency is it's really about building a coaching practice around life and not the other way around, which is what most coaches do. They build a life around a coaching practice. Then that eventually leads to burnout, health problems, and relationship problems. It may take reinventing yourself and changing how you view coaching. It may start by understanding a simple concept, which is something I talk a lot about, and the fallacy of balance. Balance doesn't exist in strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It reminds me of the four burner theory, which is in order to be successful, you're going to have to balance these four things, which is, health, family, work, social aspects of relationship. If you want to be really successful, you have to get rid of one of those. And if you want to be really, really successful, you're basically left with life and family and work.
Yeah.
And so your social aspect, all the extracurricular activities have to go. And, you know, Mike, that's not the way life works. And it doesn't work. So that doesn't work. What works is understanding that in coaching, you're going to be very, very busy during some parts of the year, and at other parts of the year, not so busy. In those parts of the year where you're really, really busy, then what you must do is make better choices with the available time that you have. But it's not about balance, because it doesn't exist. Anyone having developed mastery and excellence while living in a very, very unbalanced life, it's very difficult to be the best or trying to achieve greatness while at the same time trying to balance all these things. That is the mindset which I have found leads to burnout. And I know that not because I read it, but because I experienced it myself. I had a terrible burnout episode about 10 to 12 years ago. And so I speak from personal experience. And what burnt me out is that continuous seeking out of balance, where at some point my brain just kind of broke in half, realizing that I can't break myself into four pieces. And health suffered and everything went down the drain. And I had to sort of kind of from those ashes rose again what is now, Carve Hall Performance in its current form.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I know Bill Hartman and I have talked about this a handful of times. But, it's like a program, right? Like, you're probably not going to hit the gas on all areas of a program all at once, right? You can't do max speed and strength and power and conditioning all at the same time, and life is no different. So, there's times when work, kind of takes over a little bit, and hopefully when that backs off, work eases off, and then you get a little extra time with the family. And I mean, that's just great advice. And something else that Keir Wenham-Flat said, he was on my show a while back, he said, most professional strength coaches, meaning the guys that work with clubs, are either single or on their way to being single. And I just thought that was just such a lucid point on his part, because
very true. That's something I didn't think about, but when I think about it now, that's very true.
I mean, you just know that the grind that those guys go through for 6, 9, 10 months out of the year, man, it's a rigorous deal that they sign on for.
Yeah, when I hear those coaches or any coach talk about, how they're grinding, what they have to understand is your family is also grinding at the same time.
Yes.
And so are your children.
Yeah.
And so that's a forgotten aspect of what the grind is your family is also going through the grind.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I'm really excited about this next question, and it's so simple, but you just have just this wealth of knowledge. What advice would you give to young coaches who are listening into this show?
Stop being afraid of making mistakes. It goes back to what we were talking. Yep. Failure is growth. And in the beginning, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. I've already alluded to the fact that I've made more mistakes than probably every listener combined. That allows me a certain freedom in my thinking, and it'll give you a certain freedom in your thinking, which is mistakes are going to happen. I seem to flourish now in places that paralyzes others with the inability to make decisions because of the overwhelming amount of information. But what I'm not afraid of is I'm not afraid of failing, and I'm not afraid of making mistakes. So don't be afraid of making mistakes. Don't be afraid of falling, of failing. Don't be afraid.
Perfect. So now, big question time. I'm going to take that question and kind of flip it back on you. If you could alter the space-time continuum and give young George Carvajal one piece of advice about training and or life, what would it be?
Don't be afraid. The underlying theme running through my mind through the early part of my career was fear. I was afraid I didn't know enough. I was afraid that I couldn't get all the information out there. I was afraid to hurt athletes. I was afraid to program. I was afraid to make a mistake. I was afraid to start my business. I was afraid I wouldn't make enough money. I was afraid I wouldn't eat. I was afraid. Mm-hmm. So I would tell my young self, stop being afraid and start getting busy. Mistakes are part of life. Learn, make a note, move on in a different direction.
I love it. Okay. So George, last but not least, I've got our lightning round. Okay. So fairly short questions, but your answers can be as short or as long as you'd like. Okay.
Got it.
All right. Number one, what's your career highlight so far as a coach or clinician?
My time in Moscow.
Yeah.
Which I continue to pull from every single day.
How long were you there?
I think it was 7 or 8 months.
Wow. And how was that? Because, I mean, obviously, you're probably not speaking fluent Russian when you go over there.
No, and I lived with an American family, so 99% of the time I couldn't communicate. It was kind of writing down, you know, the language of strength and conditioning is beautiful because it ends up being about math, right?
Yeah.
And math is a universal language. But it was an interesting time, Mike, because it wasn't about the equipment. The equipment was kind of dirty and rusty. Some of the bars didn't have or had, you know, broken pieces on it, no clamps. Some of the benches were actually held together with nails and scotch tape. It was broken windows. It was a musty smell. None of that mattered. And again, it's why I keep reaching back to the simplicity of the programming, understanding that today I take out of my programs a lot more than I add to them. And I keep it simple because I realize that simple works. It doesn't mean that you make it so simple that you actually don't have an adaptation. No, obviously you have to have your T's crossed and your I's dotted because you want adaptation, right? You want the whole concept of supercompensation to happen, but that doesn't need to happen with fancy equipment. And that's what I learned from there. Is what I just reach back every time when I think, you know, I got to have this or I got to have that. You know, I started training guys, NFL guys, with whatever I could carry essentially in the back of a pickup truck at a park. That's how I started. That's how I kind of jumped in the deep end of the pool. And it looked silly and it people would kind of stare and stuff. And I realized that, you know, there's a lot of guys probably working out in million-dollar facilities. Well, I don't have that. I have the knowledge, though, and I can get you from A to B. You just have to trust. And that's how we started building those relationships. But that was a surreal time as, you know, a Cuban American, black hair and hazel eyes with a tan going to Moscow. I stood out like a sore thumb. I could not communicate with the individuals that led me, which is really more, it was, even though it was a short amount of time, what it really was an apprenticeship. Because you mentored and you apprenticed really under one individual and that one individual only. And that goes by to why I think when you start out, that's the best thing you could do is just start under that one individual. I didn't necessarily follow everything that he did later on, but it did build a foundation, a lattice work, scaffolding for that allowed then for me to move on to other things.
Yeah, that's cool. And I mean, I'm just imagining being in that environment. I mean, you just had to be so dialed in. Like, so if you can't use auditory, right, to the same degree because you're not having the verbal communication, you have to be so dialed in visually as to what's going on and being so observant. I'm just, man, I'm mind blown that, you know.
You know, something that happened, which is you just hit something that I hadn't thought about before, but it makes perfect sense, which is if you're an individual who is deaf or if you're an individual who is mute, their senses, their other senses are heightened, right?
Yes.
It's almost like this primal survival thing.
Yes.
That is exactly what I had there, is the inability to communicate allowed me to see this panoramic view of things, of whether we were at the track or the weight room, that, to be honest, over the years, Mike, I've sort of kind of lost.
Yep.
Why? Because it's changed. I didn't have to dial in those senses anymore. But back then, it was super, super developed, and I didn't really think about that. He just mentioned that, but I do remember colors were more vivid.
Mm-hmm.
I could see almost like this panoramic view of things that I obviously, you know, get older, you lose kind of that nearsightedness, but it's not really that. It's the ability to take in all this visual information that I had then that I sort of kind of have lost, because that kind of muscle memory, if you will, has not been applied.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, number two, what book or books are you reading right now?
I'm currently violating my own policy, which is only to read one book at a time.
Okay.
Just because I received a couple books in the mail, and out of respect for those people that sent it to me, I started to read them all at the same time. But the first one is The Influential Mind, The Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others by Tali Sharot.
Okay.
The second book is The Art of Fear by Kristen Ulmer, Why Conquering Fear Won't Work and What to Do Instead. And the third book is The Power of Off, The Mindful Way to Stay Sane in a Virtual World by Nancy Collier. All super important books that deal kind of with one of the things that I love besides fatigue, which is neuroscience.
Oh, those are awesome. I'll have to check those out. All right, number three. I'm excited for this one. Talk to me about surfing and BJJ.
Wow, my two loves.
I know.
So surfing and BJJ bring me the very same qualities, albeit via two different mediums, which is, you know, the mat and the ocean bring humbleness. Every day I'm reminded how little I know when I put on my gi or I paddle out. That's a constant reminder to me that in all things performance, I know nothing. I'm a proverbial kook in the water, and I have beginner's mind, or what they call a beginner white belt mentality, every time I step on the mat, regardless of, you know, currently wearing a brown belt. It's that beginner's mindset that keeps me hungry for excellence and for mastery.
I think it was maybe in Tim Ferriss's book, or maybe it was one of his podcasts where he interviewed Laird Hamilton, and maybe it was Laird and somebody else. But I believe basically I'll paraphrase, but the whole concept was like, when you're in nature and when you're in the ocean, like, it doesn't matter who you are, right? Like, you are at the mercy of nature, of the ocean, of what's going on around you. So you have to be so dialed in. So, you know, what you just said just totally reminds me of that. Like, you got to humble yourself, come in with an open mindset, beginner's mind, and really kind of take each day as its own.
Yeah. If you try and outpower the ocean, you're going to get destroyed. You're going to get a beat down. You're going to be held under, and immediately you're going to start understanding what the power of the ocean really is. The same thing with a jiu-jitsu mat. I remember making a mistake early on, thinking that I was going to fight someone that outweighed by 20 pounds and, you know, taller, bigger, faster, stronger. And in less than 5 seconds, I was tapping out after he got me in a lock. And so that reminded me very quickly that you always have to be a beginner every time you hit the ocean, every time you hit the mat. And the other quality, something that is important for me, is that it brings mindfulness, right? It's sort of like meditation in motion. It's when you're out there, you're thinking about nothing else except the next move and the next move after that. And in the ocean, it's basically the next wave and the next wave. I'm not thinking about work or bills or programming or anything else. I'm in the moment. I'm living in the moment. And it is somewhat of a lavage for the brain every time I do both. And I certainly schedule them both now as part of that philosophy of building a coaching practice around a life. Before, one of the things that burned me out is that I had no ability to establish flow in my life. You know, that time when everything becomes singular and you're not thinking about anything else. I didn't have time for it, so I never scheduled it. It was just coaching, you know, 14 hours a day, 60 hours a week. And when somebody said, hey, when's the last time you did jiu-jitsu? I couldn't tell you. And when was the last time you're in the ocean? And I said, never. It's been years. And so I changed that and made that so that now I pencil in if it's a good day and the waves are breaking, the guys know that I'm not coming until later. And at night, it's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu 3 times a week, and that there's no fail there. That is part of the programming. And then I just built coaching around that. What that's done is relieve my brain from the ability to think about balance, making better choices with the available time that I have. I choose to use it in activities that develop flow in the brain, and that keeps me healthy, wealthy, and wise when it comes to coaching.
So am I correct in the fact that literally you could set it up to where, hey, I'm not going to train until, man, I've banged out these waves or whatever. Like, that's just kind of your thing now. Like you've put that in front of coaching in a way.
That is correct.
So
yeah, that's correct.
And, so follow
and that is,
go ahead.
Yep.
Go ahead.
That is, and so I get, you know, somebody will be listening to this. And it's like, well, that must be nice. I wish I could do that. Well, you can. Mm-hmm. That's the whole deal of, you know, reinventing yourself and what coaching is I always thought coaching was, well, I'm going to coach in the NFL or, and really, again, that was not something that I aspired to, or I'm going to coach at college. Again, that's, it was, if that's what it is, then I'm going to box myself in somewhat of a sort of a 9-to-5 routine, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily 9-to-5, but boxed hours. And I thought, you know what, that doesn't work for me. That's what I did when I burnt out. And when I burnt out, I realized that in order for me to rebuild from the ashes, I would have to reinvent for me personally what coaching was. Yeah. And that would mean some consulting, and that would mean coaching at different hours so that I did the things that I wanted to do first, which included sometimes, you know, travel, you know, bow hunting trips, things like that. And then I would schedule coaching. And so again, because I don't coach for money, that's not my, at the end of the day, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking to establish a relationship with an individual first and an athlete second. And hopefully we can get it to a point where we can make micro increments into what it is that you're doing. And hopefully that ends up improving performance. But you and I can't guarantee that because that's not possible. All we can do
right.
is do the best that we can to improve your performance and factor in the ability maybe to influence a prevention of injuries because you can't stop injuries. But it has allowed me to live a kind of life that, you know, a lot of people seem to envy around the coaching world. And I get it. And I'll take those hits. I'm good with that. But at the end of the day, I built this and you can too. You just have to kind of see coaching in a different manner. If you want to coach in a facility, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, be your own boss. That's great.
Yeah.
And you know this, Mike, you're going to be the guy that cleans the floor. You're going to be the accountant. You're going to be the guy that fixes things and you're going to train people. That's what it's like. I just decided that's not what I wanted coaching to be. I wanted to build a coaching practice around the things that I love to do, which is surfing and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
So I got one follow-up and I 99% sure I know the answer, but I want to ask you. So when you made that change, what did that do to the level of your coaching?
It increased it exponentially.
Exactly.
Because I had the freedom to think and do things in a different manner. I was not, and I'll use a word, constrained anymore.
Yes. And it's the difference now. It's not I have to, I get to. Right?
That is correct. And
I
that
get
is
to coach.
Pure freedom in just hearing you say that. That is the pure freedom that where I lie in and where that statement, what that statement personifies. It's just the freedom to perform a service that I want to do. I love to do. It's not because I have to do it.
I love it. All right. Last one. What's next for George Carvajal?
So we'll be starting combine training soon in a couple of weeks. Essentially, my in-season is about to start.
Yes.
Some of my military guys are returning from deployment. I'll be at the NSA Coaches Conference in January, at the TSAC Conference in Virginia Beach in April, and I'll be speaking at Altus in June. So that's kind of going to be a busy couple of 6 or 7 months there.
No, good for you, man. Well, George, you've been awesome today, my friend. I really appreciate your time. Awesome talk. Where can my listeners find out more about you?
If you want to know more about my thoughts, my philosophy, what I consider to be important in the world of performance and strength and conditioning, I guess the easiest way is Twitter. That's probably the medium that I use on purposely the most, because I like to share information. It's the reason I got on Twitter. It wasn't necessarily to put myself out there. You and I talked about that. I prefer to be invisible in the world of coaching. Coaching is not about me. So I would say Twitter.
Okay, perfect.
Which is at Carve Performance.
At Carve Performance. Awesome. And that's, I believe, how young Hunter Charneski actually hooked us up. So
I believe so. That is correct.
I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. But again, George, thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right, everyone, that does it for this week's show. Hope you enjoyed the back and forth banter that George and I had going on. He's just an incredibly insightful guy. He's incredibly well thought. You know, he's just got great perspective on life, on coaching, and he's somebody that I think we can all learn a thing or two from. So with that being said, if you guys are listening to this, if you're a young coach, make sure save this, listen to it again from time to time, because he's got such good insights. And if you're an older coach and maybe you're mentoring a young coach, please, please, please pass this along to them, because I think it could be so beneficial for them to hear about some of the mistakes both George and I have made along the way, and that those mistakes will ultimately make them better coaches. So guys, as always, thanks for your support. I love and appreciate every one of you. Take care, and we'll be back soon with our next episode.